We got sound? All right, there we go. Before we start, if Kenny doesn't mind, I'll let him word us in a word of prayer.
Father, we are thankful for the great blessing that we have this morning to be together, to worship you, and to honor you with not only our worship this morning, but with our lives. Continue to bless us in that effort. Bless Drew in this class and others who are teaching as well, and bless all of us as we seek to know more about you. In Jesus' name, amen.
All right. I guess it was last summer, Kenny asked me to teach the high school class. And the topic was evolution. It was a book that was written by Christians about evolution, and I taught it and kind of followed along with that. When he asked me to go ahead and teach the adult class, I thought, you know, that's a good topic. It's kind of narrow. I want to expand it out a little bit more because we have a culture war going on right now with faith and religion and science. And the idea is that you side with one or side with the other, just like politics. You side Republican, you side Democrat, you side liberal, you side conservative. And it's not always that simple. When you only hear one side of an argument, that's all you know. And when you dive into both sides, you see the validity in both sides of the argument. And so this morning, I feel like it'd be a good idea to start this study off by looking at what does science say? Where are we at as a culture? Where are we at as a congregation here in North Alabama? Now, a few disclaimers. These are my opinions, and my opinions are constantly changing. This has been something I've been studying for about 14 years. When I moved up here to UNA and attended college, I realized, you know, my faith is built on what my parents put in me. My faith is built on my home congregation. You know, and I didn't really have anything to back that up. I'd heard, you know, in science classes all my life about the earth being this old. And then I took an astronomy class. The first class I took at UNA, I took astronomy just for fun. And we ran the mathematical calculations based on the speed of light and how far we can see in the universe, and 14 billion years old. But that's not what the Bible says. So how do you reconcile that when you actually look at a scientific and mathematical principle, run the numbers for yourself, run an experiment, and there are your numbers? How do you reconcile that? And so that's hopefully what I want to start out with. And this is the premise of why I want to do this. We can't be wise in our own eyes. We have to fear the Lord and depart from evil. And the idea that you can think yourself into something, you can think yourself out of something, is very powerful. I don't want us to think ourselves into believing what our culture says, what science says, but I also don't want us to just simply say, well, the preacher said, or my elders say. You know, we've got to dig into this ourselves. This is where I was saying it kind of started. In that astronomy class, we looked at this picture. And this picture is the Hubble Deep Field. So the Hubble telescope that was launched, it was built between the 80s and 90s, launched in the 90s, and it sent back these pictures. This is the darkest part of the night sky. They took the Hubble telescope, aimed it out at the darkest place they could find, and let it run a time-lapse picture for a few days. And they didn't really know what they would see. They didn't know if they would see, you know, nothing, maybe one or two stars. And you get an entire image that is covered corner to corner with galaxies. Galaxies weren't even anything we knew about. We saw this spot in the sky, the Andromeda Galaxy, that we thought it was a nebula. Nebula was a word that we were using at the time that were like what we called the cradle for building stars. Didn't know really what they were. We've only known about them for about 100 years. And then when you look at the ages that it takes light to travel, we see the Hubble Deep Field at about 1 billion years old. So, or 1 billion years from the Big Bang. And now here we are 14 billion years. Now the thing about this is light travels at a speed. It's not instantaneous. You flip a light switch on, and yes, in our room, the light comes on immediately. But when you look at light, light is a wave, just kind of like a water ripple. And just like a wave can move faster or slower in water, it's the same thing that it moves through any substance, except it's an electromagnetic wave, so it can move through the empty vacuum of space. And so it has a fixed speed. And so any distance that we look at, we can see a delay. When you look at the moon, it's under a few seconds delay, if even a few seconds. The light we see from the sun, it took 6 minutes to get here. And so when we start looking at the light from these galaxies, it took billions of years to get here. But we do the calculations through Genesis and look at the genealogies of Jesus, look at the genealogies of Abraham, and we see about 6,000 years. How do you reconcile 6,000 years with 14 billion years? That's kind of the premise that I want to address with this series of lessons. So my goals for this lesson in particular is I want to look at why this topic is necessary. Why is it something that I need to delve into? Why is it something you need to delve into? How it's applicable and why it's applicable to each of us. And if we have time today, I want to look at maybe what you believe and why do you believe it. I don't think this video is going to play, but that's okay. I can summarize it. This is Richard Dawkins. He is one of the leading atheists in the world. He is a militant atheist. One of his quotes is, "I hope that in the next 100 or so years there will not be a Christian on the face of this planet." They're basically a destroyer of this planet. Look at all a religion does. Everything it produces is war, evil, bad, conflict. And what they do is they bring up quotations from the Old Testament, you know, stone this person if they do this, kill this person, leave no one alive. They always pull out Deuteronomy, they always pull out Leviticus, they always pull out those books of the Bible to talk about how harsh and how hateful God is when addressing Christianity. Then they immediately compare it to Islam, because they'll lump Christianity and Judaism together by using those verses, and then they will show Islam and the hatred and the anger with that religion. And they say, look, there's nothing good that comes out of religion. And then they don't look at the positive aspects. They draw those aspects out, and that's where they leave it. But he goes into a couple statistics, that if you look at elite scientists, only about 10% would claim to be religious. And that's just believing some kind of God, not even the God of the Bible. And what he goes on to say is that you have to prove your faith. He said, it's not my responsibility as an atheist to defend why I don't believe there's a God. It's your responsibility to defend why you believe there is a God. And I agree with him. He doesn't say we have to prove there is a God. He says you can't prove it. He also says you can't not prove it. You know, I read a book a couple years ago called The Philosophy of Religion, and the basic premise of the book was you can neither confirm nor deny the existence of God. You can't do it. So this is an argument that will rage till the end of time. But we can deduce a few things, figure a few things out, make a few inferences that we'll talk about a little bit later in this lesson that help us maybe decide what we believe. But 1 Peter 3:15 says, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." And this is why I think this is important. We have to be able to defend our faith. And I believe that in our culture, in our society, we've done a pretty good job of defending as Christians what we believe against other denominational groups. But do we ever put any time and thought into why do I believe there's a God at all? I just feel like it. I believe it. My preacher said there was. My mom and daddy told me there was, and I don't want to think they're wrong. As a kid, that's where it started out for me. But then I had some really hard questions to address over the last 10 or 15 years. And through study and through my own looking into this, I've gotten a few answers that at this moment satisfy me. And that's one of the most important things I think I want you to take away from this. This is where I am right now on this date. I don't claim to have all the answers. I just have put some time and some study into it. And my goal here is not to be the definitive answer to you, but to hopefully spark an interest in you that you will go do your own research. You have to do your own research. You can't rely on me. If you're relying on me, then it's not going to be good enough. If you're relying on Kenny to teach you everything you need to know out of the pulpit, it's not going to be enough. If we don't take the time and the effort to build a defense for ourselves, then we're not going to have an answer to people who ask us difficult questions. So I ran some Google Trend searches, and if you don't know what Google Trends is, it's a really fun toy to play around with if you're me. Y'all probably wouldn't think so, but it lets you look at Google searches over an extended period of time, and break it down by region and break it down chronologically. So if you search for the word church and look at it globally, the United States is number two. Ghana has more searches for church, but the United States still is number two. So if you think we're an a-religious, amoral society, we look for the word church more than anywhere else in the world. This country, not just us, but then let's look at the word church by the United States. Y'all, we're in the heart of God's country. Like, this is it. You feel like everyone in the world's a Christian? Well, around here most people are, but when you leave this nice little pocket of North Alabama, South Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, Mississippi, there's not as many. If you search for Jesus, you'll see a little bit of a different shift. It's South America. It's the Catholic nations in South America with Guatemala, Nicaragua, Peru, Nigeria. Well, Nigeria and Ghana and Africa through mission efforts. But when you search for Jesus, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Louisiana, we're in the middle of this. We are the epicenter for Christianity in the world today. This is it. Also, did anybody notice a trend over time for the search for Jesus? It comes up 2 times a year. Christmas and Easter. Every year there's a spike at Christmas. Every year there's a spike at Easter. And in the summer, people don't care. So, this is actually a lesson that I taught in my science class 2 weeks ago. One of the very first things we teach every fall is the difference in observation and inference. It seems simple. It seems like, you know, you look at a picture and you know what's going on, but sometimes we, especially kids, and even adults, we've got to step back and look at the difference. So, here is a picture. I want you to look at this picture and think about what you see. If this was my class, I'd tell you to turn and talk to your partner and you discuss what you see. But just take a moment and think about what happened in this picture. What is this picture? What do you see? What happened? All right. So what are some things that we could observe? This is where you interact. We see trash. Yep, the stuff that's hanging on the rack probably will fall down, but is that an observation or an inference?
That's an inference.
That's an inference. We're looking for observations right now. What do you see in this picture?
Sand.
You see a beach, you see sand,
an umbrella.
You see an umbrella. These are the things that we see. We see sand, trash, water and waves, people, umbrella, and wood and timbers. You know, what we can infer. Based on what you see, it's probably an ocean. We may be able to make that inference. I would feel confident calling it an ocean, but it could be a gulf or a bay. It could be a sea. You know, we can infer that maybe there was a flood. Maybe this water rose up above the sand that we see there and deposited this trash. We don't know that's the case, but we can infer that. We can make that guess. May have been a tsunami. Maybe it was a giant tidal wave that deposited all this. You know, maybe these people that we see here survived it. Maybe they were there when it happened and they got through it, and that's their stuff they're trying to reclaim on this beach. Maybe it was an earthquake. Maybe an earthquake caused a tsunami and there's more devastation in the cities than there are just around this beach. Or maybe this wasn't a real situation at all. Maybe this is a movie set. Maybe everything you see in this picture was placed this way by people to look this way. Probably not. But we see one thing and our brain makes another. If you were here a few Wednesday nights ago when I taught the class, the video of the triangles being chased and the circle moving around, you know, your brain infers a lot of information. You fill in the blanks anytime you see something. You build stories and background for stuff that you don't have any more information on. That's what we're designed to do. We are built to build it, to fill in the gaps. And it lets us do a lot of great and wonderful things. But we have to be careful that we don't fill in those gaps with bad information. So, what do we see here? What are some observations you can make about this picture? See a river? You see rock.
Erosion.
You see erosion. Well, do you see erosion? It is an inference. You don't see erosion. We know erosion exists. We know that erosion is a real thing. We can observe that over an extended time in our world today. But what else do we see?
Clouds.
We see some clouds. We see the sky.
Layers.
We see layers. We see layers. So we see a canyon. We see water. We see that it's meandering. And meandering means that it follows a path that goes back and forth. And this is one of the key things that I learned from taking geomorphology. Now, geomorphology is, breaking it down, is the way, it's the study of the way the earth was formed. And I took this class, oh, it's been 12 years ago now, at UNA. We started here over at Wesleyan Hall, and we drove through Missouri, went through Real Foot Lake, up to Elephant Rocks in Missouri, over through Kansas, to Colorado, up to Yellowstone, and then back through the Badlands and back down over 2 weeks. And we studied how America was formed. That was eye-opening. To have a geography professor explain to you the processes for how things formed and everything you see, from volcanoes to earthquakes, explain how all of it happened with the scientific studies that they used. And he was a Christian, by the way. He was not an atheist trying to disprove. He believed there's a God, and he believed that a God created this. But he believed that this God created this through scientific processes over millions and millions of years. So, we see that it's meandering. We see striations in the stone. That's those stripes. We see that there's white stripes, and they're all horizontal. We're not seeing any diagonal stripes or vertical. We see levels or layers. Now, what observations can we make? We see that it appears that since this river is sitting at the bottom of this canyon, that, you know, maybe erosion that we know is true, we can observe that, has carried water through this path for millions and millions of years, and it strips away the top layer of sand and rock, and over time it wears it away. We can infer that it's millions of years old. And we can infer that maybe it was created this way. You know, there's many ways that we can look at things. And what we see is a canyon. What we don't see is how it got there. And this is what many, many people spend a lot of time building inferences to figure out what they're seeing. Let me turn on my pages since I'm going over all this. So what they're doing here, what scientists are doing as they go through this, is they're taking what they see, they're taking the observations they have that they've made over their decades of study, putting it together with what other people have studied over hundreds of years, and trying to come up with a best guess for what they have. And the problem with that is sometimes if one false step is made along the way and you build on that false step, you end up way off the path. We use a thing as humans called heuristics, and it's just better if I read it, because if I start trying to explain it, I'll make a mess of it. So any approach to problem solving or self-discovery that employs a practical method, it's not guaranteed to be optimal, perfect, or rational, but instead sufficient for reaching an immediate goal. Where finding an optimal solution is impossible or impractical, heuristic methods can be used to speed up the process of finding a satisfactory solution. Heuristics can be mental shortcuts that ease the cognitive load of decision-making. Examples that employ heuristics using a rule of thumb, an educated guess, intuitive judgment, guesstimate, profiling, or common sense. So, we can't observe things that we can't observe. I can't observe anything before 1987. I just can't. I don't have a time machine. I can't go back and tell you what the 60s were like. I wasn't there. Can I go find someone who was there and observed it? Yes, I can. The problem is, we can't observe things before our time. And we have an entire scientific community that is convinced and is confident that they can make enough inferences to build a logical, practical answer. And That's scary to me. Now, I don't want it to at all sound at any point in time like there's this block, like there's this scientific community. Science says, I listened to a Bernie Sanders interview the other day, and he kept saying, scientists say, and what it really reinforced, the whole time I'm listening to it, I'm hearing, well, all scientists agree, it's not that way. When you get into any field of study, there is disagreement. It's just like anything you do. There's disagreement all over the place. But people employ this idea of the majority. Well, 90% believe there's no God, so of course there's no God. There's these outliers, but they don't matter. This term has been used in our society to build up this idea that science is it. Science is the answer. Science is how we know stuff. You know, how did we get to this point? I think that this right here, this slide, and if you want to watch this video on YouTube, it's a very good video. Any Crash Course make a lot of really good educational videos that they look cartoony, but they're actually at a pretty good level, college level usually. And these three guys really began this movement. And the thing is, they were Christians. And Galileo, the first one, he improved the telescope. We always think of him as the telescope guy. Well, he didn't invent it. He improved it. He made a very good one, much better than what there had been at the time. And what that, for the first time, allowed to happen is you got to break free of these heuristics we just talked about. You got to go from, well, I see this, and I infer this. And they didn't, you know, sometimes we make inferences without realizing they're inferences. That's what was happening. Well, they always fell back to the ideas of previous scientists. Aristotle had been the preeminent idea of the time, Aristotelian thought. And following what he said and how things happened for 2,000 years. And without doing any research whatsoever to actually answer whether this was the case, people just said, well, Aristotle said, or Archimedes said, or this great Greek philosopher said, we'll just go with what they said without actually independently looking at the information. And that's what Galileo did. He started looking independently. He would study it for himself and use a rational comparison of theories about natural phenomena. So he would observe what he saw and record the data. Francis Bacon kind of piled on with this idea. And all three of these guys lived about the same time in different areas of Europe. And Francis Bacon said, you know, what we need to do is to experiment. And this is what I do with my students all the time. I want them to experiment in my science class. What we have them do is they run the test for themselves and find out the information they get. I don't want them to take my word for it. That doesn't require thinking. That's just the regurgitation of facts. And unfortunately, our education system for a long time, that's what it wanted. There's a big shift now away from sit and get information to active learning and experimentation and actually going through a situation, thinking through it, instead of just, here's the definitions I'm supposed to remember for the test. You know, we went through a long period of time in the educational system, and sidebar here, we were trying to make factory workers. That's where the jobs were. And what you need to do in a factory, take information, follow directions, do what you're told, and not cause any problems. And so education mirrored that. Now we're moving into a society where the main thing we need is creativity. We need problem solving. And now that's what our education system is. And it's the same thing here. What we need as Christians is not the preacher said, the bishop said, the cardinal said, the pope said. What we need is, I am studying for myself the Bible, other authors, scientific information, and gathering all of it together to find why I believe what I believe. And if I find that I'm wrong, it's my duty, my obligation to inform everyone else, hey, we need to look at this. We need to discuss this. Maybe we're wrong. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But Francis Bacon took the idea that we needed to experiment and research things. And then René Descartes, who's been one philosopher that I've really thought a lot about since my college days, taking philosophy, He said that you can't know more than you're here. Anything that you think you know, you just think you know it. All you can know is that you exist. The quote was, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And when we think about this, well, I'll go ahead. This is first Galileo. So in 1615, he wrote a letter to a queen that explained that the Bible and nature did not disagree. One was God's word to the masses, and that's a story about how to behave and why. And the other was God's work, the physical reality that he created. And that's how he kind of reconciled science and how he reconciled religion in his mind. He called for specific tests that would let experimenters confirm his laws with their own senses. This is his words, was the mark of a true scientist, independent confirmation. This is an awesome norm to try to live up to. The idea was, I'm not going to believe it unless I can test it for myself. Kind of like Thomas, he's not going to believe that Jesus is resurrected from the dead unless he can put his fingers in the nails, in the holes. And then I still remember this from my dad's 8th grade science class. This was a very powerful example of experimentation to me. This is Francesco Redi. And he was concerned with how things came to live. And this will be something we really address in a lesson in a few weeks. The idea was spontaneous generation, that flies came from rotting meat. I mean, think about it. Where do you see flies? They're always around dead things. We see maggots on them, so obviously that meat, as it degenerates, just turns into a maggot. That maggot grows up into a fly, and that's how it is. We can infer that by what we see. But he ran an experiment. He took three jars, took three pieces of meat, put them in the jars, sealed one completely, put kind of cheese paper over the top of the next one, and then left the other one totally open. Let them sit for a few days, and at the end of a few days, the one that was sealed tight, nothing. The one that had the paper over it, you had maggots on top of the paper, but not on the meat. And then the final one, of course, you had maggots and flies down in the meat. This completely debunked the science of the day that said that spontaneous generation is how things came to be. You don't get flies from meat. They're born from maggots, and then they happen to be born on the meat or wherever they can that will give an immediate food source. And this was testable. It's repeatable. You can go home and do it right now if you want to. I wouldn't recommend doing it inside, but you can do it. And this is where my issue is with science. We tend to conflate observation and inference. And I understand how it gets started. You say, well, I can see that this much erosion happens in this given time. Well, if we do this and we multiply it out, we can find an example of it. But a very good counter to that is looking at Mount St. Helens. When you look at Mount St. Helens, if you did not know that an earthquake erupted there 35 years ago, 30-something years ago, it appears that there was a lot of long-term devastation to the area. You see the huge canals cut by what appears to be water that took maybe hundreds of years or thousands or millions of years. Problem is, it was done in 8 hours. So much force went into that that it happened in a very short period of time, even though it looks like it may have taken a much longer amount of time. So, when you observe something, and this is where I'll disagree with Rene Descartes a little bit. He said that you can't trust your senses, and I'll put that up there in a moment. We have 5 senses. We can hear, see, smell, taste, and touch. And over the last few hundred years, we actually have a few more senses that we can use now. We have the EM spectrum. Light is a part of that. We can sense X-rays, radio waves. We can find different wavelengths of the EM spectrum beyond visible light. When you see these beautiful pictures of space and stuff, that's not visible light. They're taking radio waves or they're taking X-rays or some other part of the spectrum and colorizing it to what your eyes can see. We also have magnetism. We can detect magnetic waves and magnetic field lines. We can detect those. And we can also use mathematics. Observation is the active acquisition of information from a primary source. In living beings, observation employs the senses. In science, observation can also involve the perception and recording of data via the use of scientific instruments. The term may also refer to any data collected during the scientific activity. Observations can be qualitative, that is, only the absence or presence of property is noted, or quantitative, if a numerical value is attached to the observed phenomenon by counting or measuring. In my EDS classes that Jason and I just finished, we had to do a qualitative or quantitative research study. And this is where you take an idea, and I believe yours was quantitative too, wasn't it? Yeah, both of us did quantitative. It's a lot easier to run numbers than it is to figure out qualities of something. But we actually came up with a premise and tested it. We ran the scientific method and used this data to answer our questions that we had. That's what science does. We observed this data, and we observed it through mathematics. You can use more than just your five senses to observe things. And this is where Descartes said you can't really trust any of it. He observed knowledge obtained through the senses lacks absolute certainty because the senses often deceive us. And this is true. You know, hallucinations, you can hear a sound and immediately your mind makes up a crazy story about somebody trying to break in the house and it was nothing. And we do this all the time. And we sometimes think we observed it when really all we're doing is inferring from it. So human reason can also be deceived. Logical conclusions from false premises will lead you to wrong answers. And that is my issue with science in a lot of people's minds. We tend to believe, I have this information and it means this. Well, you don't have all that. And besides, when you took someone else's word for it, you had faith in that person. Your faith comes from a person that came from their research that you didn't fully examine. You may know a lot about the research they did, and we'll look at some scientific experiments and some different studies that were not wholly truthful. And so for my last slide, what ends up happening is we rely on what we can observe. Now here's a very interesting situation. Dark matter is a form of matter thought to account for approximately 85% of the matter in the universe and about a quarter of its total energy density. The majority of dark matter is thought to be non-baryonic nature in nature, possibly being composed of some as yet undiscovered subatomic particles. Here's the main thing I want you to take from this. Its presence is implied in a variety of astrophysical observations, including gravitational effects, which cannot be explained by accepted theories of gravity unless more matter is present that can be seen. For this reason, most experts think dark matter to be abundant in the universe and to have had strong influence on the structure of evolution. Dark matter is called dark because it does not appear to interact with observable electromagnetic radiation such as light and is thus invisible to the entire electromagnetic spectrum, making it undetectable using existing astronomical instruments. Here we see an example of we have this observation and we are afraid to go beyond that and imply and infer much else. I think this is fine science. We have this thing. We detect all these properties that mean it's probably there, but we don't know anything about it, so we're waiting till we have more information. That's how we should approach our spiritual life. I have this amount of information, and based on what I have, this is where I am right now. I am fluid in that. My faith is what it is because of what I have observed, what I believe, based on study and evidence that I have to believe in that. If our faith is coming from mom and dad, if our faith is coming from it's what I've always believed and I'm afraid to challenge that, that's a problem. When I was young, I really liked playing video games. And I bought a game that talked about Greek mythology and Norse mythology and Egyptian mythology. And my mother said, I'm kind of afraid for you to play this. I don't want you to lose your faith. And I thought, you know, and this was as a 12 or 13-year-old, I thought, shouldn't I be challenging that? If I'm this easily swayed by something else, I need to expose myself to more disagreement. If I put myself in a in an echo chamber and all I hear is the same story, that's where I'm going to stay. And that's why a lot of people outside of Christianity think that we're not very intelligent. We leave ourselves in an echo chamber and listen to only what we want to hear. So hopefully this study will give us some more information that we can look at and challenge our faith. Thank you.